And good afternoon, everybody. Deep breath. My name is Zeke. This is Movement Museum. It's about 2:05 on December 3rd, I think today is. This is Movement Museum talking about dance in Montreal on your radio. And I am here with...
Allison.
And...
Gwen.
And...
Samantha.
And yeah, howdy. We're all going to be talking about all sorts of stuff, but yes, obviously because I don't have my focus right now, would somebody please toss in some poem or something like that so I can get myself organized?
All right, I chose what I believe to be a fairly appropriate poem for today. It's called Belly Dancer, and it's by Diane Wachowski, and here we go. Can these movements, which move themselves, be the substance of my attraction? Where does this thin green silk come from that covers my body? Surely any woman wearing such fabrics would move her body just to feel them touching every part of her. Yet most of the women frown, or look away, or laugh stiffly. They are afraid of these materials and these movements in some way. The psychologists would say that they are afraid of themselves somehow. Perhaps awakening too much desire that their men could never satisfy, so that they keep themselves laced and buttoned and made up, in hopes that the framework will keep them stiff enough not to feel the whole register. In hopes that they will not have to experience that unquenchable desire for rhythm and contact. If a snake glided across this floor, most of them would faint or shrink away. Yet that movement could be their own. That smooth movement frightens them. Awakening ancestors and relatives to the tips of the arms and toes. So my bare feet and my thin green silks, my bells and finger cymbals offend them, frighten their old young bodies, while the men simper and leer, glad for the vicarious experience and exercise. They do not realize how I scorn them or how I dance for their frightened, unawakened, sweet women. And again, that's Belly Dancer by Diane Wachowski, who is, I'm told, a contemporary American poet who writes often about personal experiences.
Cool.
There you go.
Thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay. And so, yes, Samantha, you are here today to be interviewed because you are a belly dancer.
I am.
An oriental dancer.
Oriental dancer,
and
yes.
And there are other terms as well. I was doing some quick research beforehand,
yes.
And it's got lots and lots of fancy things and languages I can't even understand.
Yeah, maybe you could tell us a little bit about all of the dances that you do before we start talking about, I don't know, what you do.
Okay. Well, I guess the most well-known would be what we call here belly dancing, which most of us prefer the term oriental dance. In Quebec, it's called baladi, which is not really correct, but many people know by that. So I do that, which many people know and I've seen in films and all that. And I do other styles, folklore of the North Africa, Middle East, and Sub-Saharan Africa. And I have a background in classical dance as well. And some other things, many other styles.
Cool. So how did it all begin for you? Like, how did you decide that this was your thing, kind of, and that you wanted to, like, get into it, I guess?
The Oriental?
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, I had been training in modern dance and before that, jazz and ballet. And I actually didn't start with Oriental. I was drawn to some other, I guess what you'd call ethnic styles, non-Western, particularly African dance. Ended up going to Africa twice to study and got really immersed in that. And then was always drawn to something a little more of the oriental side of the music of where I had been studying in Africa, West Africa, and eventually wanted to try class and tried a class of, let's call it belly dance, oriental dance. And the one thing led to another, and here I am. All these years later,
so
still doing it.
What was it in that class that was like, that clicked for you? Like, what is it? What's the draw, or what is it in that form?
For me, it's the music.
Yeah.
100%. There's nothing else. I mean, nothing else. The sensation of doing it feels really good too. If we're talking about Oriental, but it's the music. It's, that's it. It's very simple. Yeah.
Cool. And when you were, where were you in Africa studying, dance when you like, at first?
I did two trips to West Africa. So throughout that time, I'd been in Senegal several times, the Gambia, Guinea, or Guinea-Conakry, and Mali, studying dance with different groups, local styles.
And have you studied, in Morocco or Egypt or...?
I did study in Egypt years later,
okay.
In 2006, I believe it was. I did make a trip to Egypt to study. So I'd had many teachers here and in the States and all over. And I decided I needed to go. Because when you're studying certain types of dance, that I really believe it's important to go see... Not just see, but really immerse yourself in the context of it and at its source. So it's sort of an essential part of it.
So have you had a chance to dance at a wedding yet? Like with people who are...
Oh, yeah.
Many.
Lots. Oh, tons. Yeah. Lots of times. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think is the most misunderstood aspect of the kind of dancing that you're doing? Like the way, you know, as it translates into Western context, how does that work?
There's two things. One is the sexuality of it. People often think it's overly sexual or sensual. I'm not sure that it's the which in fact there's nothing wrong with that, but that it's to please men or something like that, which is it's the last thing I'm thinking of when I'm dancing. So there's that aspect, and that's in both this context as well as I'd say in the Middle East, and also the fact of that it's not really difficult or artistic, so because it does cross into boundary, it crosses both sides of a sort of, I'd say, social kind of entertainment, like weddings, and you can take it all the way to sort of a high art, let's say, stage performance. But many people think I'd put it on a level, I'd say, with, you know, clowns and entertainment. So that's really disappointing, because so that's there's those two aspects that are the most misunderstood.
Can I ask a quick question here? I once had a conversation with a belly dancer, and she expressed the same kind of, I don't know, distaste for that view of belly dancing. And she was like, it's much more empowering for women than it is kind of objectifying, because she was explaining the roots of it being about childbirth and preparing your muscles. Do you have anything to add about the history of belly dance?
Well, nobody knows, actually.
Okay.
People talk. But really, there's no proof. A lot of people talk about childbirth, and there's no doubt that you're using most of the muscles, I imagine. I haven't had children, but that you would be using, you know, pelvic muscles, very base muscles, core muscles. So that's very likely. People talk about different things, but nobody knows, because it hasn't been recorded. Dance in the Middle East is not really... It has a really like tenuous role, so people haven't written a lot about it or researched it. I mean, they have researched it, but there's no ancient proof of it was this or that. But all I do know is that for women, it feels very good and very natural to be using those parts of your body, and it is very, I'd say, empowering. You know, you feel you discover something in yourself that's really strong. In using certain parts of your body, and it's not at all to please someone else any more than any other dance style is meant to be aesthetically pleasing, if it's meant to be that. But it does feel really good, and a lot of women find, and that's partly why it's so popular all around the world, and I mean all around the world, global now, China, Brazil, France, whatever, that women I think are drawn to it, not more than other dance styles, but they do find something in it that's very satisfying. So I do that. But there's no, I really have to say, I don't think there's any proof of any ancient historical roots. But we don't know. So it's hard to say.
Yeah, as I was trying to do research, I didn't read up many academic treatises on belly dancing's history. But there was, talk, I think, on Wikipedia. So who knows what that really means about even possibly having a history before, pre-Islamic history in Iraq, or parts of Babylon or something. I don't know if that's possible, but so I don't know. What do you think about the whole tradition? How does that feel to you to have, especially as somebody whose, personal history isn't possibly maybe not rooted in the tradition of those parts? Do you feel a connection to that still, or for you is it just Do you feel rooted in the history at all? Or, you know, like there's this line here that says, yeah, awakening ancestors and relatives to the tips of the arms and toes. And I'm wondering, like, mm-hmm, do you feel that kind of connection or long, like,
I think so. I mean, it's sort of, I guess that's the personal side of it, but, you know, like we're saying, we don't know about the history, but no doubt there are many dances that use the pelvic area throughout. There's many styles. So we can't say there is, it did exist, but what we see now is very different. I would say the history has really evolved since, you know, some, like, who knows what styles of dance were being done, but there are many that are with that root. So I think it does awaken something. Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, some people take it much further, and, you know, you can go wherever you want with that, but it's sort of a, I don't want to say primal, but it's using this core part of your body. It's very, what would be the word? It's very,
grounded, maybe?
Yeah. You feel like you're going to something very at its source, in a sense. But, I mean, I personally have no cultural, historical, ancestral connection, very little to that part of the world. So I can't say in that sense, but yeah. Mm-hmm. But also what we perform today is very, very different. It's also very far from that.
Yeah.
So there's sort of these, you go in and out of these modes, you know.
Do you feel like you have to make kind of sacrifices and become more aesthetically pleasing to, you know, find yourself employed and whatnot? And
yes.
Yeah.
Well, there's the, yes.
Do you still find time to get your pleasure out of this kind of dance, though?
Like I said, it goes in between. I'd say there's because it's roots, or in belly dance, let's call it that. Everybody understands that. Is a social dance. If you go to a party. Now, and when I'm talking about the Middle East, I'm talking about this dance is Egyptian, Lebanese, and Turkish. There are many other dances, and a lot of countries in the Middle East they know what this dance is, but it's not their dance. So just to clarify that. So in parties, people do dance like that, men and women, men a little slightly differently, but with those basic movements. So there is that sort of, and it evolved for professional dancers to dance in weddings, family events, very social kind of events. So, so that's where it comes from. So we do a lot of that kind of work. You know, it's not, you're not there for pure art, you know, artistic reasons. You're there for entertainment. It could be symbolic for many reasons, why we dance at weddings, for example. And then there would be like the, and you do have, you know, there are cultural expectations of how you should look and how you should act. And I think probably if you study any dance, there's that in a certain sense. So yeah, if you want to, you do have to understand the codes, if you want, of that culture, of that, those, you know, if you want to work in it. And then there's what I would call more artistic shows where, you know, you can do more other things, what you want. You're there not just for entertainment. So it's funny dance because it goes in and out of these two realms. And you do have to adapt and, you know, you don't have to, but you have to understand that there are, those expectations might be there. You don't have to conform to them, but I think it's important to understand them. Yeah. So.
Now, if I can ask a question, are there any, because let me spit this out properly. In the cursory research I've done, realized that there's an awful lot of sort of North American culture that has imposed itself and
yes,
sort of taken, that it's like, Little Egypt as the song, which sort of is that whole thing. And then finding out that there actually was a dance troupe at some world fair two
yeah,
centuries ago and so on. But there are there, like, I would imagine that between Turkish and Egyptian and Lebanese, there are regional differences.
Oh, yes.
Are there regional differences between, say, Montreal, Chicago, and LA as well? Or Detroit, which actually has a large Middle Eastern population,
yeah,
as well. Are there regional differences here as there?
Well, first, the largest category would be people say, do you do Egyptian, do you do Turkish, or do you do American? Mm-hmm.
So, and then what are the differences?
So American, there are lots of differences, and that's just like larger. And then within America, you can get like, you know, little regional differences. But generally, the home of this dance, the root, when people talk about it, they talk about Egypt. Women are extremely grounded. The movements are fairly simple. They have a deep connection to the music. You usually have an orchestra. and the audience also understands what's going on. So it's very different. Turkish, again, similar thing. They're a little less grounded, a little more, it's different. Because Turkish music is different. And what happens when you, I think what you get when you get the American, and that sort of means everybody that's non-Egyptian or Turkish or Lebanese, is that you get people who, like myself, who have to learn about all those steps. So we tend to be much more technical, throwing in a lot of accessories, flying all over the place, and showing off a little more than interpreting. So Egyptian dancers tend to interpret more, very simple, very soft, very deep. And it's harder for us because we don't have, we have to learn a lot of steps. So that would be, and I'm, not every, of course, there are American dancers who dance very Egyptian style and Egyptian dancers who, you know, show off. It's general. But we don't necessarily understand the words of the songs. We don't necessarily, we have a CD instead of musicians. Sometimes we have musicians. You're often dancing for audiences who don't know what you're doing. So they have an expectation. It depends if you're dancing for audiences who understand. So there's a lot of factors. So generally, you get a whole different thing. The example would be if you, there's a, the most well-known example would be the American troupe Belly Dance Superstars, created by Miles Copeland, who was the also the manager for the Police, created a international touring company of American belly dancers, the spectacular sort of Las Vegas type event. Great dancers, very skilled, very different than what would happen in the Middle East, in Egypt, for example. So you can have your preference. I have mine, but it's definitely different within the States and then within France and Germany. You probably get little different styles too, but yeah.
So when you're talking about, like, you're kind of talking, setting up something like the language of belly dancing, almost like people understanding and then also interpreting. Is it just song or like what's being told, I guess, in that
in a
context
song? Or in
I guess, yeah, like, or what are the dancers generally telling and how do they speak, I guess?
Well, I'm talking about, when I talk about this, I try to always talk about the original source. So I'm not talking about American dance, but we can talk about that. But it's not as a storytelling dance, for example, like Indian dance, which would be storytelling, or it's emotion based.
Okay.
So, I mean, there are pop songs that are really silly and like just light, you know, the words are not very deep and it's rather cute and sassy. But generally, you're not looking to tell an actual story. You're looking to transmit emotion through your movements. And there are many other dances in the Middle East that are not, you know, this is a female, a solo female improvised dance. There are group dances, there are male dances, there are work dances. So this is, I'm just talking about this one. Usually it's you're essentially trying to become, like as one of the big dancers, Nagua Fad said, you're trying to become the music. And the music is very emotional, the good music. So it's not necessarily telling an actual story. It's transmitting emotion.
Okay.
Rather than showing technical proficiency, which you are also as a dancer, you know, any style you need to do. So that would be where, again, the difference becomes, you know, when it's not just learning steps, I guess in any dance, it's not just learning steps where you can take it to that next level. But that's really, like I'd say, the what the goal would be through your technical, you know, your movements is to show emotion. So, yeah, and it's really based in the, you know, the pelvic area and the hands are not, you know, telling stories, your eyes are not.
Okay.
In that really literal sense, as like Indian dance, or even I'd say it's a little more on par with flamenco. You know, this emotional feeling through an amazing physical performance. So,
do you feel like when you do this kind of dance, you're how does that feel for you to like work through that emotion? Does it? Do you just feel like you're transmitting something like directly? Is that what kind of the draw is for you, like you're connecting to the music in this way that's kind of like
ideally and ultimately when that works that's amazing. Of course, you know, we train and everything, it's you want to work your body and obviously you need, I'm not saying you don't need technical training, but you know, I guess like in any dance, when you get to that next level and it's you sort of transcend the physical and that's what's amazing. And if you can project that to the audience and they react well, then you've done your
that's it.
And if we're lucky to have musicians and you have sort of the triangle of you know, this thing of the audience, the dancer, and the musicians. Sometimes we don't, so it's a little, you know, CD's a little more drier than live musicians, but it can be quite magical. And you can see dancers, you know, and be very touched by it. But it's not literally a storytelling, but that's, yeah, I mean, that would be great if that happened every time. Sometimes it obviously doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah.
Cool. Yeah. That just made belly dancing really special to me.
Unfortunately, this is part of what we were saying before, is that what we see most of is the entertainment side.
Right.
You go to a party, Christmas party or a restaurant, and that's probably not where the dancer is going to show her, go into that place of, you know, it can happen, but it's a little less often. So that's not what we see, which is unfortunate, because then people think you're just there to entertain and sort of shake things around, and which is unfortunate because you miss out on the more magical side of a performance, a real performance.
Yeah.
So instead of just animating a party or something.
Yeah. But,
so we kind of, you know, have to do both. Yeah.
In describing the different styles, you emphasize the relationship between the audience a lot, which I find is really interesting. Is your ideal audience the informed audience that's prepared for that emotional
yes.
journey? Yeah. And I'm trying to paint this picture in my mind. What's the ideal musician or musicians? What would be your dream performance?
Well, again, the audience, yeah, an informed audience, I suppose it's similar in any dance style. I mean, you can always reach somebody, but no matter what, but an informed audience would be great. And it's that you're this is, I guess, what attracted me in the first place to some aspects of some, the styles I chose to study in more non-Western styles, is that there's a little more than I've had personally found in, you know, modern and ballet, where you have this, you're not separated from the audience mm-hmm. or from musicians, depending on. So, you know, ideally, yeah, you would have this kind of, like I said, triangle of energy going on, and you're all reacting to one another, and it becomes
more democratic kind of arrangement, less proscenium.
Yeah, and it's not a one-way street. Mm. And I guess it never is, but and the informed audience does participate in an event.
With you know, applause energy, with
yeah, I mean, and even this is even not in dance, but in you know, more older musical styles, people do shout things and they respond, mm-hmm. literally respond. So it's okay to respond, and it's okay, and if you're moved, you respond to it, and that feeds the performance, and then it's just a circle of energy, I would suppose, and I suppose that's true in any, like, you know, kind of artistic performance, but particularly in this context, yeah. And without dancer too, it can happen. So that's the, when those moments happen, I mean, it's not often, maybe it's not often here, but it's amazing. Yeah, you feel like you're part of something. So it's not just about you, it's not just, you know, the performance, it's a moment, you're trying to get to that moment together with all those musicians and, or, you know, audience. Yeah, it sort of takes all the criteria to sort of get there. It sometimes it gets there and sometimes it doesn't. So that would be that's wow. Yeah, in fact, in Arabic there's a whole term for this. They have a word for they call it a sort of type of ecstasy, so that happens in those moments. Usually it's not referring to dance, usually it's referring to singing and musical performance. Where there's a moment, and they call it, people can go into a state of sort of ecstasy, the musicians, singers, and the audience together. And it's, we don't have this word in English or in French. It just doesn't exist in our mental vocabulary. And it's something people would expect, musicians, or not expect, but it can happen. So if you know it can happen, it can happen. So it's that would be the ideal situation.
Wonderful. I wonder if we don't have that word because we're not expecting it. We're not waiting for it in English.
Well, yeah, it's sort of chicken or egg. You know, if you don't think it can happen, it won't happen. Yeah. So the word, it's what they call a state of tarab. It's like a...
Tarab.
They literally translated sweetness or ecstasy, where people get so emotionally moved by something, but it takes a certain criteria. So, I mean, in Oriental dance, you know, we do a lot of performing that's not going to get to that state, and that's very okay. But that's an amazing goal.
I guess there's this whole thing. I don't know if we've really talked about it or touched on it, but being a woman and being a belly dancer and how that works for you, and how that's, I guess there's also that partly works with the misrepresentations and possibly, but also, I don't know, do you want to speak about that at all, or do you have anything to say, really? Or has it all been said?
No, it's a really deep issue. Really complex. Really complex. Like I said, it's a female, solo female dance. Now you do see a lot of troops, but originally it really is a female solo dance. So you're up there.
That takes a lot of guts,
as a
especially.
Woman alone, and alone. I mean, you're not alone. You might have musicians, and if you think of the context, the original context, it's pretty interesting because for a woman to be a professional dancer in the Middle East, it's not really a good thing. It's not really a respectable thing. So it goes into these, ideas of what's proper, what's not proper. So yet she has this power when she's up there. So it's a kind of a crazy, what's the word? Paradox. A paradox, is that the word? You know,
yeah.
In a sense, it's like you're not supposed to, but women do it, and they're, it's not very respected, but they do have this amazing power. Now, if we go here, it's a bit different, but it is quite, it's amazing. And I think people really they really focus on that idea that the costumes we wear and are a little more revealing than, I don't know, they think it's too sexual, but it really isn't, or at least that's not how it feels, but yet it is a powerful thing, kind of, to have your body there, I guess in any dance, I could say that. So it goes, it's a really complex issue, yeah. I don't even know where to go with that one. It goes really deep, really, really deep. And because the basis of your movements are in your torso. So for some reason here we have this idea that if you move your pelvic area, that's sexual. Whereas, it's not necessarily the case. We could have said that for ballet, people freaked out on legs but we have this idea here, so which it's not how it feels, but it's a very empowering thing. Yeah,
maybe sure. It's one of those things where we're just so used to heads that the further down you go, or the more uncomfortable we get or something. I'm not quite sure, but
I think so. I don't know where it comes from, but it's we direct association, which is definitely not necessarily the case, so,
yeah.
I wonder
if things have been or will be getting better as society gets a little bit more comfortable with sexuality and being open about that and stuff. Because I think it's not, I mean, from my perspective, it is sexual, but it not in a negative context, mm-hmm. in that powerful context. And it's like, as soon as we get more comfortable with that, mm-hmm. in general, are we going to, open up and start to respect a little bit more that style?
That would be great.
Do you
and
feel that
I don't
that
know
happened?
What the problem is. I mean, I see other dance forms that are.
That's what I was just thinking now that I think about the costuming, I can see how maybe that was an idea, at the beginning of the century, maybe when, mm-hmm. Or something like that, that maybe it's revealing or whatever. But now actually, I mean, in terms of revealing, mm-hmm. it's probably not really, just watch the American Music Awards, possibly.
Yes.
You'll see more. I don't know.
And it is culturally based because you have to think that that's not what women danced in before. Like I said, it's a social dance. Women would dance in what they're wearing.
Well, right.
They might be dressed up for a party, so they have a nicer dress on, but they did not show their stomachs.
So
women do not dress like that, obviously, in the streets of Cairo. It's not,
yeah.
God forbid. But they wear dresses. And even now, people do wear fully covered dresses. But that costume was very influenced by Hollywood. You just had a huge film industry, and was influenced by Hollywood at the same time, early black and white films, and we get these spangly costumes. So now here, if you don't wear it, people are like, oh, what is that, but It's women don't necessarily dress like that. Obviously, they don't dress like that, but you know, they do wear fully covered costumes and not necessarily showing their stomach area. So that's, and you know, the judgment there might be different than what we judge here. So it gets a little complex.
Yeah.
But we don't have to wear those costumes. You can wear something covered. Yeah. And folkloric styles do not wear those costumes, obviously. Yeah, it's a very Hollywood kind of image, glamour, rhinestones everywhere.
What about the bells and finger symbols and things like that? Were those pre-Hollywood?
Yeah, finger symbols are an instrument, and they are part of the orchestra.
Right.
There is somebody in the orchestra who plays that those symbols, and women dance with them. That is an old type of instrument, so that's fine. Yeah. And then, I mean, the idea of having coins on your costume, there are like bases in these, but now it's, you know, it's just the sort of the two piece where you're showing your midriff sort of, and you can see the stereotypes right away. I dream of genie kind of, you know, thing. We don't wear quite that, but, I have to say it's pretty much an invented costume. Now it's standard. It is a standard. But it wasn't always like that. Yeah.
Is it fun to dress up in regardless, or is it a fun costume to wear? I don't know.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
Yeah.
It's okay. I remember one friend I had who was belly dancing, and she was like, actually, it's kind of fun. Like, we're all dressing up. We look super hot, and like, we go out and dance, and it's fun, you know? Like, I don't know.
It's definitely fun to get dressed up, and it's really feminine, and
yeah,
you're bringing all that out, so it is really fun. Yeah,
yeah.
But I also love putting on a very folkloric dress, and it's a whole different feeling. So it depends. It brings out different sides of your femininity. Yeah,
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
If I can interject here for a second, we have two ads to play, and if you give me a minute and a half, I can play them both, and we can then get back to more of the conversation.
Excellent.
Hold on 1 second. Howdy. I'm Zeke. We're talking about dance on your radio as part of Movement Museum here on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's also movement-museum.blogspot.com on your computer. I think we're available on Twitter sometimes when I get around to it, or if I can convince somebody else to help me with the tweeting silly stuff. And then there's also Facebook. And there is, just about any place. We have in studio now with us Samantha Burns, who is an Oriental dancer.
Samantha Bernstein.
Bernstein, sorry.
Thank you.
I'm Burns.
Oh, man.
We have a Burns and a Bernstein in the house.
And we have a very embarrassed and red-faced technical host who is trying to pull his foot out of his mouth. They're just so as to get it out of the way first, early and fast. It's your website is Sana Dance. Is that how I pronounce it?
Yeah.
SanaaDance.com. Did I get it
yes,
right?
Yes, dance, like dance in
yes.
French.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
No problem. And that's, yeah, everybody should go there. Click hard, click often, click lots.
Thanks.
And is there anything else, I guess, that you just wanted to say as we're closing up here, or anything that you think the world should know about?
Yeah, you're playing anywhere?
Your art form? Or where you're dancing, or where you're teaching, or anything.
Yes, I do teach, and well, right now it's over for the session, and have performances. Some are private, some are public. You can look on the website and see them. But I guess the main thing, I think most Oriental dancers, people working or enjoying this dance form would like, you know, is for people to really understand and respect it, and understand that we work really hard, and that we love it, and that it is a beautiful art form. You know, that has its origins a little far away, but and to treat it with the respect that, you know, that it deserves, because we love it.
Cool. So
yes,
that's www.sanaadance.com, and you can find the place to either call Samantha if you want her to come to your party, and you can find out where she's teaching in the new year, and I don't know, look at some amazing pictures of Samantha dancing. too, which is cool.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks
for having me.
And yes, now on to other business, because we all saw a whatchamacallit show on the weekend.
We did.
Yes.
We meant to have a meeting, but instead we went to a bar and watched people dance.
How weird is that?
It was pretty weird. Mm. It was pretty fantastic.
That's my favorite type of meeting.
Although we got lots of meeting business done. Now, the one thing I wanted to get out of the way early and quick about this, because yes, it was Amp-Credence, which I've interviewed Marie-Ève Albert, who is the founder and discoverer and head honcho behind it, which is basically, improvised contact dance in a competitive arena. And we got to see the Blues and the Yellows. And on the Yellow team was Justine Ricard, who was the captain, Ariane Boulette, Milan Gervais, Luliku Shibayo. I think I'm getting her name right. I hope I did. And Manuel Schenk. On the Blues, there was Angelique Poulin, who was the captain, Claudine Dubé, Rosalie Familar, Jean-François Legaret, and Marie-Ève Rivard. And what did you guys think about it?
Oh, I thought it was a brilliant form, and the dancers were so much fun. Really strong performers.
Because, yeah, no, I was quite impressed as well. I was actually just realizing that I was getting tense there, because it was the sort of thing where it started off and it looked like the Yellows were going to run away with it. They'd sort of got a two-match lead. I don't know what the terminology is in the vocabulary with this is. But it was the sort of thing where... Yeah, did you have any... I can have a list here of all the things. You just want to recite through what happened, how, and so on, and then you guys interject with what you thought, or do you want to start off and I then...
Well, I was just going to say that maybe we should, you know, let everybody know that it was sort of like set up, you know, there was like a ring almost, and we were all sitting around, and we were watching these two teams battle it out in improv dance, I guess. Improv dance is like maybe the term for it, I'm not quite sure. And then we all had, we were given a blue card and a yellow card. And so the audience was deciding and the ref was leading the whole thing. And so we were putting up one of our tickets and saying which one we wanted to win this particular round, either yellow or blue. I was rooting for the yellow. I think I'm the only one in the room.
No, I was rooting for yellow as well.
Really?
I tried to go per competition, you know, per round, who I thought got
I was going for the best. Round too, but then halfway through, I was like, I don't think yellow's going to make it. And so then I started hitting it hard because I was really behind them for some reason. Anyways, what else would you like to say?
No, it was the... First thing was that they did 11 matches, I would imagine, these were 11 rounds. Actually, that probably would be the term, 11 rounds. The first one was an A to Z, where, if I remember correctly, you choose one team starts, one team finishes, or one team chooses the beginning and the end, and then the second team does the middle to get them from point A to point Z. And it was... Yeah, the lifting of a heavy object was the start to actual dancing, and then somehow in the way, if I remember correctly, it was Blue who did the middle. They lifted up one person, and it was won by Blue. The second one was comparison between the two teams with an object which they used as a Labatt 50 bottle. The Blues decided that they were going to do spin the bottle, which I thought was rather lame. And I think everybody else sort of decided it was rather lame because Yellow used it like a unicorn horn for the most part, and it was won by Yellow, and so they were off to the races. And then the third match was what they called a mixed relay, which I'm not entirely certain I understood why they were alternating back and forth between dancers. I don't think I got anything out of it because, as my notes say here, nothing too impressive except for the head slide. However, it was won by Yellow, so Yellow at this point was leading 2-1. And then in the fourth match, they had a comparison with restrictions, the restrictions being no hands. And by the way, you guys can jump in if you have any other different memories of any of the rounds. So far, so good? Okay. No hands, where the Blues started off with what appeared to be a brilliant move designed to slay the competition by doing YMCA with their arms in their sleeves, so that they were doing it sort of with their elbows, but then they suddenly realized that there was a little bit too much time, and they didn't know all the verses. They only knew sort of the chorus, and so they tried to then morph into something else, and they got a penalty for lack of focus. And yes, I should also mention that the Yellows in the second round got a penalty for going outside of the ring. And I'm not entirely certain, do you know, like, if the penalties caused any sort of thing other than the referee saying you got a penalty and causing a lot of booze?
Yeah, it was just for the booze, maybe. And maybe trying to influence the audience's vote, either blue or yellow.
Okay.
I think yellow also got a penalty for talking during the other.
Yeah, no, that was on the, well, where was it? And hold on, let me pull up my paper here.
They weren't supposed to discuss what they were going to do while the other group was performing.
That was at the eighth round.
Oh, okay.
We were getting there. We're getting there.
All right.
And yes, then yellow just did more. Didn't more dancing, and so blue got the penalty for lack of focus, as I said. But the score then was won by yellow. The score is now 3-1 for yellow. The fifth round was with a theme, which the theme was chaos theory, and I wrote who can be more chaotic than the other, which leads me to think that the dances were sort of just vague and amorphous. It was won by blue. They seemed to be coming back. It was yellow 3 and blue 2 at the end of the fifth round. Then we had the much more break. You going to say something?
I was thinking that there's like 8 rounds.
11.
11 rounds. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe we could just talk about whether we liked it or not and whether we thought it worked. And, you know, like...
I think
it worked. And I think that it's definitely a fun thing to do. It's a Sanka set, right, at Cafe Campus. And, you know, like, it's $8. One of your bucks goes to Fondation Martin Matt. And I think it worked. What do you guys think? Do you think it was like fun and interesting? Or
I mean, it was totally accessible. Like, it was understandable what was going on. All the themes were like so clearly defined. And you got to watch these people in action. You got to watch their brilliance. You know, how they chose the strongest people for the chosen competition. Like, that was really exciting. And like, just giving and taking. And sometimes they had to dance together, both teams at once. And just like being really open and friendly and, you know, and helping each other out was great. And they even had like audience participation with the voting too, and also asking for suggestions at least one point in time.
Yeah, for themes. At the end there was the theme where everybody had to shout out themes for each individual dancer, and that was what lost it for the yellows, because the blues actually were on the ball. And they had come back from a 5-3 deficit, and they came back to 5-5 and then won it in the last round.
Yeah, and excitement, right? You can't help but getting involved in that kind of competitive.
And it's cool because they got to highlight each dancer in that case. So then we got to see each person for what they had to offer. That was pretty cool. Yeah, it was fun, I think. And they're going to do it again because there's these four teams. And so there's blue and the yellows, the greens and the blues, the reds and the blues, the yellows and the greens. It's going all the way until the 25th of April.
Yeah, and they do once every 2 months.
Once every 2 months.
Yeah, so the next one is, what, end of January? You have
next
the thing there?
Next one is the 12th of January, in Laval. Oh. École Curie Antoine Labelle.
Okay, when's the next one that's at Café Campus?
Nuit Blanche. I think there's a Nuit Blanche. They're going to do all four teams are going to be at Nuit Blanche on the 27th of February. But...
Oh, you're looking at...
these are the out-of-season matches.
Yeah, the regular season is the 31st of January, which is reds versus yellows.
And is that at Café Campus again?
Yes, that's at Café Campus. And yes, the Nuit Blanche stuff is lots and lots of fun.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen it before?
The last Nuit Blanche, I stopped by at the beginning to see it, but then because just Nuit Blanche is getting way too crowded for me. And so I sort of said, wow, there's a lot of crowd. And I said, thanks, let's get the hell out of Dodge. Hence why I like the Cafe Campus, because it was, as I had, think I've written down some places, there's a very nice buzz at the beginning. It was everybody was excitement.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, I don't know if it was just that having that many dancers brings in so many people or what, but it really felt like a community event, and it was fun, you know, like it was like, yeah, exciting. And everybody was having a beer, and so it was chill on a Sunday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
cool.
I'll be going back.
Okay, I'll see you there. We just won't have a meeting. And then, yes, last night I got to see Divers Soir with Angelo Laurier, which is, interesting in the best use of the word, because it's she's a contortionist who uses her family as the content for her shows. And I was trying to think of, I've spent the whole sort of night and day trying to think of other art forms that use their family as the content of stuff. And there's Christopher Milne, who I know just because I was named after Christopher Milne, and then the surprise, actually born on the same day as A.A. Milne. which is very woo, woo. And my folks didn't even know that, but hush, hush. Then there's also, what's her name? The photographer I can't stand, who got famous in the 70s for taking snapshots of basically her friends, and it was all just very intimate stuff of like drug use and so on and so forth, and I just said, yeah, whatever. And I'm certain there are tons and tons more out there, and it is just extremely raw to be using that, something that is that personal for something that is that public as a performance. And so I'm going to start off here from the press release that they came out with, because without this, it's the sort of thing where it is the reason for it being. And so let me start. Angela Doré n'est pas raisonnable. À 45 ans passés, alors qu'à cet âge, les contorsionnistes ont déjà renoncé depuis au moins d'une décennie à leur éprouvante spécialité, elle continue. Cette Française d'adoption épouse une nouvelle carrière d'auteur scénique et de metteur en scène après avoir brillé dans leur super-production circassienne telle celle du Cirque du Soleil. En France, son parcours passé notamment par des substances alliant lieu d'excellence dans la détection des formes artistiques émergentes et peu classables. And that's the key thing. It's, you really can't classify it as anything because she's a contortionist, but she's using video and she's sort of, what you might call, ripping open her heart and her brain about her family up there on stage. And I'm just saying, if it was weird that I was named after Christopher Robin and born on the same day as AML, this is even weirder. Déversoir est une tentative de mystification de la folie. Mon métier de contorsionniste est mon oxtore alienante. Ma famille, je la porte en moi. I.e. the contortionism in her is her exterior shell. Her family is her interior. Après une coupure de plus de 3 ans avec mon père, j'ai ressenti le besoin de renouer par l'intermédiaire de la caméra. J'ai trouvé une façon de reprendre contact, de réapproprier pour qu'elle puisse se raconter. And this is where it just got into just weirdness, is the sort of thing. Yes, it's, I know that I have personally with my father sort of difficulties. I imagine most people have at various points in their life some difficulties with their parents, whether it is 2 years old and you're not getting fed at the right time and so you just make lots of noise, or whether you're 55 years old and at which point they aren't giving the emotional support you need and so you make lots of noise. For the most part, though, they tend to be personal. And then yes, this whole contortionism stuff, one of the things that I found extremely compelling about it, but at the same time off-putting, was that there's one point, and there's, for the most part, her contortionism, take a step back. In the theater, she is, there's a big video screen, and it shows, for the most part, home movies of her dad talking about him being depressed when he was a child, getting electroshock therapy, then getting married, and then his son being diagnosed, her brother being diagnosed with schizophrenia, him getting electroshock therapy as well, him just being completely off the map as far as being, what would it be, somebody you'd run into in just on the street. He is definitely out on the fringes. And that's on playing on the video for the most part, interspersed. There are specific stories and so on that they tell. Then she, as the contortionist, does an awful lot of what I assume are called back bends, where it's your hands are on the floor, your belly's up in the air, although the belly is sort of flat and your feet are there, and she then walks around, scurries around on sort of four legs and stuff like that. There's there was one thing talking with the friend that I went to, is don't really have any point of comparison to know, is this amazing? Well, it was to me amazing contortionism and so on, just because I can't do that and I've never seen anybody do that, and understanding that she is older than I am and doing that sort of stuff, you say, oh my God. But it's then trying to connect that to the videos becomes extremely sticking Baskin and Robbins ice cream and rocket ships together.
So it didn't work for you?
No, it really did in a weird way. It's obviously designed to make people uncomfortable, because yes, if I start pouring my heart out to you here on the air about how like my life is so horrible and I had electroshock therapy and at which point I'm depressed and this, that, and the other thing, you're going to initially first be repelled, and the whole idea. And now as I'm thinking off the seat of my pants, I see the light going on in my head, because yes, that is which one? Repulsive and repulsing and forcing people away, because most people are not quite prepared for that amount of just emotion, raw emotion and personal stuff. Contortionism, for the most part, is the bending of the body into really bizarre shapes that are repulsive. It's the sort of thing where the only way to sort of make them vaguely interesting is when you get those 12-year-old Oriental girls who can sort of stick their stuff, you don't know where, and at which point suddenly there is, you add in that whole aura of sexuality, which is then again probably repulsive, to my mind, very repulsive. And I see that because it's there when you see a body that is like where the head, the feet are in, sticking out of the top of the head and so on, you say, oh, weird. And so now, yeah, the connection between the two repulsions, but then sticking it up on stage so that you can't be repulsed, you actually have to get into it. I think I finally unlocked the key to it. Thank you very much. Deep breath, because yes, there's one part in it that is absolutely super spectacular that is really, really weird as well, because she ends up with both her feet behind her ears and the toes up above her head, and she is lying on her back, and then her other brother places a video camera on her crotch so it is facing her in the face. The video then is put up on the screen. She is never facing the audience when she is doing this whole thing, but she is, because she's facing the camera. The camera and the video are facing the screen. She then goes into this whole monologue about stuff, and I'm just sort of like trying to figure out, okay, so do I watch and pay attention to the video, or I'm actually riveted and paying attention to her on the floor? And is just, yeah, that sort of stuff, I just say, wow. And and I think it is all, as I wrote in my notes at the bottom, at the end, just before everybody started applauding, catharsis. It's so on and so forth. It's just get it out of there, get it all out so that somebody else can deal with it. I don't need it anymore.
Cool.
It plays at La Chapelle tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday, Friday the 4th, Saturday the 5th at 8 o'clock, Sunday the 6th at 5 o'clock, and highly, highly recommended, especially now that I actually figured it out on air. I'm so pleased with myself.
Cool. And so I guess we're almost done, but maybe there's one or two things that need to be mentioned that are happening this week.
I'm going to spit out a couple of plugs on the tail end of that one. Dancing in My Unbirthday Suit, Xmas Edition, brought to you by Inertia Productions, which may or may not happen to be my collective, will be performing on the 10th, that's next Thursday, at Mainline Theater. And we're also going to have Uncalled For, which is a physical theater improv group, doing Today Is All Your Birthdays as our opener. It's going to be at 9 p.m., it's $10, and you can call Mainline Theater at 514-849-3378 for tickets.
And when is it again?
Next Thursday, the 11th of December.
Okay, and then whose company is it?
Inertia Productions.
And who's involved in Inertia Productions?
Me!
Cool.
Allison Elizabeth Burns and company. And it's going to be so much fun. You are going to laugh until you cry. That's a promise. And I have one other little thing I wanted to mention. It's called Layer One, Things We Leave Unsaid. This is a mixed media show, contemporary dance, performance art, and I believe some installation business as well, if I'm not wrong. Plus, you know, DJ drinks, little something to eat on Saturday night. $7, doors open at 8, shows at 9, that's December 5th once again. And it's at Studio L'Espace, 4532 Rue Laval. And what these girls are doing is something really interesting, is that they're trying to really invite the audience into their creation process. So if you search Proceeding in Layers on YouTube or on Facebook, that's Proceeding in Layers, you'll find videos about their process and whatnot. And really, they're kind of inviting you in to discover that whole business. And then Layer One, Things We've Left Unsaid, which is their show on Saturday, is their, you know, step one of presentation. So that should be a lot of fun.
Cool. And then I think we might even have Jose Navas in studio next week. It's not guaranteed, but I'm about 80% of the way there. I'd like to thank everybody. Samantha Bernstein, thank you very, very much for coming in. Thank you especially for hanging out and listening to us rant and rave about stuff after the fact.
If anybody wants to say anything to Samantha, too, you can always email us and we'll email it to her if that's easier because we're moving the museum.
And yes, her website again is sanadance, sanaadanse.com. We are Movement Museum. We're running overtime here. Primetime is being very nice and giving us all sorts of positive vibes. Movement Museum, CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, movement-museum.blogspot.com on your computer, Twitter, Facebook, and I realize, you can also find us on iTunes. I think we actually have, we're going up the charts, and at some point I'm going to have to go find somebody with iTunes so I can see where we are if you stick in Montreal Dance, and I bet you we're number one in the search for Montreal.
Number one!
But yes.
Assuming.
But how many other Montreal Dance stuff, dance podcasts do you think there are on iTunes?
Fair enough. Mm-hmm.
So yes, thank you all for listening. Have a wonderful week. We will see you here at the same bat time, same bat channel. Yeah.